Chapter 40. Justice Delayed. January the 2nd, 1588. Executed, George Hernlein of Brook, Jobst No of Bamberg, a potter, both of them murderers and robbers. 2 years ago, Hernlein and a companion attacked a carrier on the Remeroit, stabbing him 4 times so that he died and took 32 florins. 6 weeks ago, he and No were consorting with a whore. She bore a male child in the house where No baptised it, then cut off its hand while alive. Then a companion called Schwartz tossed the child in the air so that it fell upon the table and said, "How the devil whines!" and then cut its throat and buried it in the garden. The two murderers were led out on a tumbrel. Both their arms were twice nipped with red-hot tongs, and then their right arms and legs broken. Lastly, they were executed on the wheel. This sickening and hair-raising account comes from the diary of Franz Schmidt, the public executioner of Nuremberg from 1573 until 1617. Broken on the wheel meant that the men were stretched out on a wheel, then their limbs smashed with a sharp-edged bar, so they were almost literally hacked to pieces. Schmidt's diary is one of the most horrible documents in criminal literature, both on account of the crimes it describes and the punishments inflicted. Criminals were tortured, burned, hanged, and beheaded. But perhaps the most sobering fact that emerges from Schmidt's diary is that many people who were imprisoned without real cause, for being aliens or destitute or vagrants, spent their lives in the dark and airless dungeons of the Nuremberg jail. Conditions were so appalling that even when they were released, they were often broken in health or insane. Prisoners were supposed to pay the jailer for their keep. If they had no money, they had to promise to pay later. And if they had no means of paying, they might spend years in the wettest and coldest cell until they died. In medieval Nuremberg, a quick execution could be preferable to the normal endless delay of justice. It's a point worth bearing in mind when dealing with justice delayed. Liberals refer to the treatment of Carol Chessman, the red light bandit whose execution for rape was repeatedly delayed, as barbarous. But at least Chessman received ample legal advice and was publicly tried. In the 20th century, justice may be delayed for a long time, but it finally arrives. However, it's only in fairly recent times that there was any real concern over justice and its application. Even in the days of Charles Dickens, a man could be imprisoned in London's Fleet Prison for his debts and spend the next 10 years there, with no means of earning the money to pay them off. Justice delayed was the rule, not the exception, in earlier centuries. Naturally, the records of such cases are scarce. Nobody cared enough to write about them. But one of them is still famous in France, because the victims were championed by a man with a powerful sense of justice, Voltaire. His indignation was sharpened by an event that took place when he was already a famous playwright and philosopher. His acid wit had offended a nobleman, the Chevalier de Rohan. One day, when Voltaire was eating dinner with a duke, a messenger arrived saying someone wanted to speak to him. He went to the door and was dragged out by ruffians who beat him black and blue while the Chevalier looked on and encouraged them. Voltaire was enraged. He took lessons in fencing and prepared for vengeance. Rohan whispered a word in the ear of a royal minister, and Voltaire was thrown into the Bastille and released only on condition that he left France. 36 years later, in 1761, Voltaire became involved in another case of apparent injustice, when a young man was found dead in a house in Toulouse. He was 28-year-old Marc-Antoine Calas, and he had a rope mark around his neck and a bruise under the ear. The Calas family, in whose house the death took place, were Protestants, very much a minority in Roman Catholic France. Marc-Antoine Calas was intending to become a Catholic, and his father was opposed to it. Immediately, everyone jumped to the conclusion that Marc had been murdered to prevent him renouncing his Protestantism. France was shocked and enraged. Although all the evidence pointed towards suicide, and the dead man was known to be of a romantic and melancholy disposition, and torn by conflicts about his religion, the father was accused of his murder. Monsieur Calas's defence was that his son had killed himself in a unique way, by opening 2 doors of a storehouse, balancing a rolling pin across them, and then hanging himself with a rope from this rolling pin. According to the father, Mark was already dead when his distressed relatives found him. Their first thought was of the disgrace of a suicide in the family, so Mark was carefully taken down and the rope and rolling pin were hidden. A sort of tie was placed around the dead man's neck to hide the rope mark. Calas stupidly hoped that his death would be regarded as being due to apoplexy. The doctor who removed the silk tie remarked that Marc-Antoine had been strangled. When the cellar of the Calas house was searched later, the investigators discovered a ring in the ceiling from which a man could have been hanged. Calas was duly tried and sentenced to death. His limbs were broken on the wheel, then he was strangled. It was widely expected that the rest of the family would receive a similar fate, but the law was comparatively lenient. The daughters were placed in a convent, the mother and sons went into exile. At this point, Voltaire became interested in the case. He proceeded to ask questions. His conclusion was that Marc-Antoine had lost a great deal of money at cards that day and had hanged himself out of remorse and fear. He was a big man, the biggest in the family. His 62-year-old father was, by comparison, frail. How could Jean Calas possibly have overpowered and hanged his son? Voltaire's one-man campaign was successful. Protestant churches all over Europe subscribed money for the Calas family. In March 1764, royal councillors met at Versailles and in a four-hour sitting decided to ask the Parliament of Toulouse to explain why Jean Calas had been executed. A year later, it was decided that Calas had been wrongfully executed and that the rest of the family were innocent. Their property was restored. Voltaire remarked with satisfaction that it was the finest fifth act the theatre can give us. After a delay of 4 years, justice had triumphed. Or had it? In the 1920s, a French writer, Marc Chassaigne, re-examined the evidence, as well as Voltaire's brilliant defence of Calas. He concluded that in all probability, Calas had murdered his son after a violent quarrel with the help of Marc-Antoine's brothers. Servants heard shrieks and a cry of murder not long before the body was discovered. Experiments with the storeroom doors and the rolling pin showed that it was almost impossible for a man to have hanged himself as Jean Calas described. He believes that Calas and several members of his family were guilty. If he's correct, this is perhaps the longest case of justice delayed on record. Whether or not Voltaire was mistaken, he inspired other men of conscience to crusade for justice. When in 1898 the novelist Émile Zola called upon all his powers of invective to defend Captain Alfred Dreyfus, he almost certainly had Voltaire's example in mind. The Dreyfus affair was one of the most popular cause célèbre of all time. In 1894 a document was discovered, addressed to the German military attaché in Paris, listing secret French papers that the writer was willing to supply to the Germans. Suspicion fell on Dreyfus, an army officer who was also a Jew and an Alsatian, both despised minorities. Because the handwriting on the document resembled Dreyfus's, he was sentenced to life imprisonment on Devil's Island in 1894. While there, he never ceased to protest his innocence. He had been in prison for almost 2 years when a French cleaner who worked for the German embassy in Paris found a letter, torn up in a wastepaper basket, mentioning a certain Commandant Esterhazy. The woman was also in the employ of French intelligence, who investigated Esterhazy and found that he was dissolute, a gambler, and that his handwriting was very similar to Dreyfus's. Yet the case was still so hot that the authorities ignored this new evidence. The famous criminologist Bertillon, whose handwriting expertise had condemned Dreyfus, affirmed without hesitation that Esterhazy's handwriting was identical with Dreyfus's. On the strength of that, Dreyfus's brother started an outcry which was taken up by the French newspapers. Suddenly, all France was split by passionate argument about the case. As in the Calas case, it was the Roman Catholics who continued to believe Dreyfus guilty. Left-wingers and anti-clericals declared him innocent. In an attempt to settle the controversy, Major Esterhazy was tried by a military court and acquitted. The Catholics and reactionaries accused anyone who defended Dreyfus of being bought by Jewish gold. On hearing this, the renowned novelist Émile Zola, regarded by many as a muckraker and a pornographer, hurled himself into the case with some passionate pro-Dreyfus articles. Then he produced a bombshell of an article called J'accuse, an attack upon the authorities and justice of the day. The mobs yelled, "Death to Zola!" and smashed the windows of the statesman Georges Clemenceau, another Dreyfusard. Zola's accusations of chicanery were so violent that he was put on trial and sentenced to a year's imprisonment. He then fled to England, where he continued to work for Dreyfus. At this point, the French resorted to the old English problem-solving method of compromise. Dreyfus was brought back from Devil's Island and retried. The court found him guilty, but with extenuating circumstances, for which he was pardoned. Dreyfus's name was still tarnished, so the fight went on. A retrial took place in 1899, and 7 years after that, the Supreme Court of Appeals at last cleared Dreyfus. He was readmitted to the army, given the Legion of Honour, and promoted. Zola and his faith in justice had triumphed. Because of their involvement in the affair, half the army chiefs of staff had been sacked or demoted. Yet many Frenchmen continued to believe in Dreyfus's guilt, and did so until 1930, when the publication of the papers of the German military attaché, Schwarzkopfen, proved conclusively that it was Esterhazy who had betrayed his country. Dreyfus died 5 years later. He had taken 36 years to finally establish his innocence. Compared with the Dreyfus case, usually known simply as L'Affaire, all other cases of justice delayed seem anticlimactic. Yet the criminal records of both Britain and the United States can show examples just as disturbing in their implications. In one of these, the creator of Sherlock Holmes, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, played a similar leading role to that of Zola in the Dreyfus scandal. The case in question occurred in 1903 and involved a kind of Jack the Ripper who confined his sadistic attention to animals. The unknown maniac operated near the village of Great Wyley in Staffordshire. He would creep up to animals in the night, horses, cows, sheep, and disembowel them with a very sharp knife. Like the more infamous Ripper, he also wrote jeering letters to the police, urging them to try and catch him. He then threatened to use his knife on little girls in the district. The vicar of Great Wyley at the time was a Persian, the Reverend Sir Purji Idalji, and the locals were suspicious of foreigners. Neither did they much like his eldest son, 27-year-old George Idalji, a Birmingham solicitor who lived at home. He was a small, nervous man with bulging eyes. 10 years earlier, when George was at school, there had been an ugly campaign of hoaxes directed against his father. Respectable people received obscene letters signed Sir Purji Idalji. George Idalji had been suspected of these hoaxes at the time. Now, because he was a foreigner, he was again suspected of being the culprit. Accordingly, the police searched his room and found some cutthroat razors and boots with mud on them. Some of his clothes were taken away and packed in the same bundle as a strip of hide from a mutilated pony. Not surprisingly, they were found to be covered with horsehairs later. George Idalji was tried and sentenced to 7 years penal servitude. He was released after 3 years, but found it impossible to get work. He then appealed to Conan Doyle. As soon as Doyle met him, he noted Idalji's short-sighted, bulging eyes. Such a man would never have been able to see in the dark to mutilate the animals. Doyle applied the methods of his own Sherlock Holmes. He read the anonymous letters and deduced that they were written by a youth with sadistic leanings who had a grudge against the headmaster of Idalji's old school and who subsequently became a sailor. The letters referred to going to sea, and this would also explain the time gap between the two sets of outrages. He soon traced a boy who had been expelled from the school, who loved ripping railway cushions with a sharp knife, and who indulged in forgery. Doyle duly sent a long report to the Home Office. A committee examined it and decided that Idalji was not guilty of cattle maiming, but, they said, he had written the anonymous letters. In a rage, Conan Doyle wrote a series of forceful articles in the Daily Telegraph. He submitted the anonymous letters to an expert who had testified in the Dreyfus case and who verified that they were the work of the sadistic schoolboy. However, unlike Dreyfus, Idalji was never completely exonerated, and the real criminal was never brought to trial. Another case in which Doyle took a keen interest had a more satisfactory outcome. In 1895, a Norwegian mining engineer named Adolf Beck was walking down Victoria Street in London when a woman named Madame Meissonier thought that she recognised him as a man who had swindled her. Beck was arrested, and the police soon established, to their own satisfaction, that he was a petty swindler named Wilhelm Meyer, alias John Smith, who often preyed on women, and who had gone to jail in 1887. All Beck's protestations of innocence were useless. Other swindled women declared he was the culprit, and he was sent to prison for 7 years. 2 years later, the Home Office checked a list of John Smith's characteristics and discovered that Smith was circumcised. Beck wasn't. However, the judge in the case stubbornly decided that there was no cause for interference, and Beck remained a prisoner. In 1901, after his release, his bad luck again caught up with him. There had been more frauds on women. Beck was again arrested for the crimes of John Smith. He made a dramatic appeal to the press to help establish his innocence, an appeal that aroused the interest of many notable figures, including Conan Doyle. But this time, fate intervened on Beck's behalf. After his arrests, the frauds on women continued, and were so similar in nature to those of which Beck was accused that even the police realised that something was wrong. Then, while Beck was being tried, the actual culprit was arrested while pawning some of his ill-gotten gains. Wilhelm Meyer, alias John Smith, alias Turner and Thomas. Meyer and Beck proved to be incredibly alike, although Meyer's face was coarser, even their handwriting was similar. Beck was granted a pardon and awarded £6,000 in compensation. He later married a younger woman and died peacefully in 1948. It was largely due to this case, and to that of George Dalgie, that a court of criminal appeal was finally set up in England. But it remained a disgrace to British justice that Beck remained in prison until 1901, although his innocence had been fully established 3 years earlier. The classic case of justice delayed in the United States began in 1923 in Waukegan, Illinois. The Ku Klux Klan were active in the area, as they wanted to keep Waukegan all white. Police were often involved in framing Negroes on bootlegging charges. A 30-year-old Negro named Jim Montgomery, a property owner, tried to stir his fellow black men to resistance. In turn, the Klan decided to put him away. The method chosen was simple but effective. A semi-imbecile white woman of 62, Mamie Snow, was bribed to go to the police and to allege that Montgomery had raped her. His protests of innocence were ignored. After a trial lasting a mere 12 minutes, he was sentenced to life imprisonment. Oddly enough, the other prisoners believed his story, that he had been framed, perhaps because he had the look of an honest man, but he had been in jail for 20 years before one brave individual decided to investigate the rumours. In 1944, a lawyer named Louis Kuttner listened to Montgomery's story and embarked on the near-impossible task of proving him innocent. First, he looked up the medical evidence and discovered that there was none. No doctor had been called to assert that Mamie Snow had been raped. Mamie Snow herself was long dead, and yet a doctor must have examined her. She had been sent to Victory Memorial Hospital in Waukegan to be examined for rape. Kuttner next visited the hospital and asked to see the records. He was curtly refused. He persisted quietly, and after many attempts, managed to persuade a young night receptionist to let him into the basement where the records were kept. It took him 8 nights to finally locate the relevant document. Then he discovered that the doctor who had examined Mamie Snow, John E. Walter, had found no evidence of rape. Why, Kuttner wondered, had he not testified in Montgomery's defence? Discovering that Dr. Walter was still alive, Kuttner called on him, and finally forced him to talk about the case by threatening to throw him out of the window. Walter admitted that the Klan had warned him to keep quiet, and, after all, Montgomery was only a nigger. Kuttner then located the nurse who had assisted Walter in the examination. She agreed that Mamie Snow had been a virgin when Walter examined her. Kuttner needed one more piece of evidence, proof that the Klan had framed Montgomery. He got this by burgling the Waukegan office of the Ku Klux Klan. It took several hours, even with a squad of helpers, to turn up the document that gave details of the plot against Montgomery. At last, he had what he wanted. With this evidence, he was allowed to investigate police records of the case, which revealed that, on the day after Montgomery's arrest, Mamie Snow had failed to identify him in jail. The petition for Montgomery's release on a writ of habeas corpus was heard on June the 27th, 1947. Dr. Walter testified in court that the prosecutor himself had been involved in the plot. 2 months later, on August the 10th, 1947, Montgomery, now a white-haired man of 54, was granted a pardon. He was given $10, the sum usually granted to discharged prisoners. And that was all he ever did receive, although Kuttner pressed for $150,000 compensation. The tax authorities declined to allow Kuttner's claim for $5,000 allowance for the time that he had spent on the case, over 2 years. They felt that the cause of justice for a Negro was not important enough to justify such a hefty claim.